Serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. The following program comes from the Focus 580 archive, so that means for the next hour, we'll not be taking your calls. Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls. Immediately after the attacks of 9/11, there was an outpouring of both sympathy and support for the United States and the people of the United States. And it came from all over the world, many, many governments and many people around the world. It seemed, though, that that support began to erode fairly quickly. And now, we argue that support for the United States around the world is at an historic low point. Perhaps not as low as it's ever been, but certainly low. Our is in as much disarray as it seems to be. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Dennis Ross, former Middle East envoy and peace negotiator. And he says that if one wants to know what's been missing in our foreign policy in recent years, he says the answer is statecraft. He argues that the Bush administration's problems stem from its inability to use the tools that we have, diplomatic, economic, and military, to advance our interests. And he explores this in some greater depth and detail in a newly published book that we'll be talking about this morning. The title of his book is Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. Farrar Straus Giroux is the publisher of the book. Dennis Ross served as Middle East envoy and chief peace negotiator in the presidential administrations of George H.W. Bush, first President Bush, and also Bill Clinton. He is now counselor and distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Mr. Ross, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for talking with us.
Nice to be with you.
We appreciate it. The book is the entire book really is dedicated, I think, to explaining, to providing answer to this question that you pose, what is statecraft? But having said that, if I could say to you, well, in 25 words or less, tell me what is statecraft, can you give a brief answer?
Yeah, I can. The essence of statecraft is that it's the what and the how of your foreign policy. Good statecraft depends upon being able to marry your objectives with your means. If your objectives are ill-informed, misguided, you're not going to have very good statecraft. If you have very good objectives but you don't know how to carry them out, you don't know how to implement them, you're not going to have very good statecraft. If you look at a case like Iraq, what you see is a classic example of having a mismatch between objectives and means. So the key to good statecraft is being able to marry your objectives and means, and there's a lot of things that go into that, but that's the essence.
Mm-hmm. In this, that particular case, what really was the problem? Was it because you say, yes, what this involves in is knowing how to use the tools that you have to meet your objectives, but at the same time, the objectives have to be clear. They have to fit in. You have to have goals. They have to be reasonable goals. They have to, in a sense, fit into the larger context in which you're operating. So there are a lot of things that have to, a lot of pieces here that have to be in place to be, for statecraft to be successful. What, in that particular case, if we're talking about Iraq, where was the big misstep, do you think?
Well, the misstep, and this is going to be typical in a lot of cases, I suspect, when things go badly, you have to have what I call reality-based assessments, not faith-based assessments, meaning you have to see the world as it is, not as you wish it would be. In Iraq, the Bush administration operated on a premise that everything would fall into place when Saddam fell, not fall apart. That was a faith-based assessment. It wasn't a reality-based assessment. Had there been a reality-based assessment, the administration would have known there was a high probability of an insurgency because Sunnis have dominated this area, Iraq, what is known as Iraq, the last 400 years, even though they were not the majority there. They were never easily going to accept dominance and control and governance by the Shia. The Shia, having always been an underclass and certainly treated as an underclass by Saddam Hussein, were going to feel it was their time and their right, and they were not about to be magnanimous in terms of how they approached the Sunnis. So you had a fundamental divide in terms of how the Sunnis were going to see their situation. The Shia were likely to be in a position where they felt that they could be at risk of losing their power once they now suddenly finally had it. So the ability to recognize that you'd have an insurgency, that there was a high potential for sectarian conflict, that there was going to be a vacuum once Saddam Hussein departed the scene because he dominated and so completely dominated the system, all of those factors had to be taken into account before you went in. It didn't mean you couldn't go in. It didn't mean that Iraq was one of these objectives that was simply not one that could ever have been achieved, but it meant that you had to understand what you were getting into, and you had to shape accordingly what you would do. You had to realize what were the means you had available. You would have to use much larger forces. You would have to focus very quickly on having those Iraqis emerge on the scene who were prepared to build bridges between the different groups, not focus on the difference between the different groups. You'd have to have an Iraqi indigenous leadership shaping administration almost from the beginning. And you'd have to have the U.S. not being an administrator. The last thing you needed was having a U.S. administrator, a coalition provision authority headed by someone like Jerry Bremer. You didn't need that because that was going to make us a symbol of occupation, making it easier to sustain an insurgency. So my point here is that a reality-based assessment would have told you what you were getting into and would have given you at least a better chance to shape means that would have fit what you were trying to do. It certainly would have changed the scale and character of what you thought you were going to produce within Iraq. This is another example, by the way. The administration frequently has had what I call very far-reaching, ambitious, transformative kinds of objectives, but they've usually applied minimalist means. And that's what I think, again, if you look at the Middle East, if you're going to talk about transforming the Middle East into a democracy, you better understand what you're getting into and what the limits of what you can do are, what you're going to need to be able to be successful, who you're going to need help from to be successful. All of this has been lacking so far, certainly in Iraq.
One of the most frequent criticisms, I think, of the Bush administration has been its willingness to go it alone. To set a policy, to say this is the policy of the United States, and to say to the rest of the world, if you don't support it, that's too bad. We don't care. We're going to do this anyway, and if we have to do it alone, we will. There is something here that you write early in the book that I did find a little bit surprising, and that is you write that this conventional wisdom that the Bush policy is unilateralist is wrong.
Yeah, I think there's a difference between saying that the Bush administration's attitude was it's really sort of our way or no way, and a notion that the Bush administration has only operated in terms of a unilateralist posture. The fact is, when it comes to North Korea, the administration's policy was basically to rely upon others. Throughout the first term of the Bush administration on Iran, there was a divide between those in the administration who wanted regime change as a policy and engagement as a policy. Nothing was ever decided, so we simply supported what the Europeans were doing. So here are two cases where, in fact, the nature of the approach was, in effect, multilateral, but not informed in a very clear way multilaterally. Multilateral or unilateral, those represent means. They're not objectives. Again, I come back to the essence of statecraft is recognizing how you marry your objectives and your means, and also how you acquire leverage. So if you're going to change the behavior of others, one of the things you're going to have to be able to do is you're going to have to be able to have leverage on those that you want to be able to influence. To do that frequently, your own means are not going to be enough. You're going to need the means of others. You're going to have to mobilize or persuade others to join you. In the case of the Bush administration, when they've used multilateralism, which I'm suggesting they have on a number of occasions, they haven't been very effective when they've done it.
Well, I think it's interesting you draw some comparisons here between the effort of the first Bush administration to secure international support for the first Gulf War and what happened the second time around, and that in fact the reason perhaps that the United States didn't get broad support for the Iraq War was that the United States government and those people whose job it is to do this, like the State Department and Secretary of State, that they really didn't make an effort to go out and build that support as had been done by the president's father first time around.
Absolutely the case. I mean, Turkey is a wonderful example of that. In 1990-1991, the Secretary of State, Jim Baker, made three trips to Turkey in the space of 5 months. The president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, made between 55 and 60 phone calls to the leader of Turkey. and obviously he was calling others as well, but 55 to 60 phone calls. The Turks had, at least from a public standpoint, were also hesitant about being involved or in any way supporting a war against Iraq in 1990-91. But all the effort, I mean, it's not just the trips, it's not just the phone calls, it's giving others a platform on which to say their views are being solicited, they're being listened to, their views are being taken into account, they're not being put in a position or put into a corner. They have their own political explanation to deal with their own public. Every time Baker would go, he gave a wonderful platform to the then president of Turkey, Özal, to stand up and say, with Baker standing next to him, here's why we're going to do what we're going to do based on our interests. The Americans may be asking certain things, but they're also providing certain things, and in any case, they're coming to us. Contrast that with 2002-2003. There wasn't a single trip by the Secretary of State there. The most high-level person who went to Turkey was the Deputy Secretary of Defense, which might be fine, except the Deputy Secretary of Defense going indicates in its pure symbolism that this is all about how we're going to use force, and it doesn't give the Turkish government the ability to explain that their views are really being listened to or taken into account, or even to give a platform to talk about why they're going to do what they're going to do. And even in that circumstance, when it came time for a vote within the Turkish parliament, there's 514 votes that were cast. The vote to not support us was a vote that prevailed only by 3 out of 514. So had there been even a modicum of statecraft, it's quite possible Turkey would have joined us. And you may recall at the time we had originally planned in terms of the military operations, there was supposed to be a northern front where we were going to operate from Turkey. That had to be transformed, and that actually changed, I think, the character of what went on the ground.
Would, though, I suppose one would could ask the question, would it, even in this particular case, a case of the United States going into Iraq, if we had exercised exemplary statecraft, if it was not the case that countries around the world saw that it was in their interest to support us and to participate, they wouldn't. So could it have just been in a particular case that, say, again, if we're taking a look at the first Gulf War and the Iraq War, that there were enough reasons for countries the first time around to believe that there was something in it for them, and that the second time around that they didn't, and that perhaps it would not have mattered what we said or how we tried to sell it, we still wouldn't have gotten a lot of support?
Well, it's certainly a fair point that there's a distinction. But let's look at this from a couple of different dimensions. Number one, in the run-up to the first Gulf War, there was a sequence of steps that the administration pursued. First, there was condemnation at the Security Council, which was achieved. Then there was sanctions that were voted. Then there were sanctions enforcement that was adopted. Later on, there was an all-necessary means resolution that was adopted with a clock. So there was an unmistakable sequence of steps that were pursued, and the perception was it was pursued with a fair amount of patience, on the one hand, and with a constant effort to talk to all those involved in this coalition at every phase. When you went from condemnation to sanctions, you were crossing one threshold. When you went from sanctions to sanctions enforcement, you were crossing another threshold. When you went from sanctions enforcement to an all-necessary means resolution that meant, in fact, you could use force, you went to another level. Each one of those phases you went into involved very serious discussions where when Baker would go to see the leaders, and he was constantly traveling, he would basically say to them in private, we're going to do this. What is it that we can do that will make it easier for you? So there was really a solicitation at every phase, every step of the process. In 2002-2003, yes, we get one Security Council resolution. Then we push for another one. The president even says he wants everybody to lay their cards on the table. Then it's clear we can't achieve it, so we withdraw it. Now, interestingly enough, at the time, two of those who were on the fence on the second resolution, Mexico and Chile, said to us, give us another 45 to 60 days and we'd be prepared to support it. With that, we would have had 10 votes, and it could have passed because, notwithstanding where the French were, the French really weren't prepared to veto, and the Russians weren't going to veto either. So we actually would have had a resolution. We ended up going to war, and the impression that was created is that we were going to war over the opposition of the Security Council. Again, just to show the comparison to the past, In the time of the All Necessary Means Resolution, when Baker first raised that in the councils within the administration and with some of the allies, Prime Minister Thatcher of Great Britain and then Secretary of Defense Cheney and then National Security Advisor Scowcroft were all leery about the idea of going for an All Necessary Means Resolution because they said, look, what if you go for it and you can't get it? Then it'll look like we're going to war over opposition. That becomes very problematic. Baker said to them, we won't go for it. In a sense, we won't surface it. It won't become visible unless we know we have the votes to do it. Now, here you see just the opposite done in 2003 when we publicly go for a second resolution and then it turns out we can't get it. Now, this again comes back to what I call elementary statecraft. Elementary statecraft is knowing how to communicate. It's listening as much as talking. It's knowing how to persuade. It's recognizing that it takes an effort. It means that every phone call or every visit is guided by an objective. And every single one of those is designed to either reassure those who have potential problems, respond to the needs that they raise, work through problems that might emerge. You can't just assume things. You can't leave anything to chance. You have to work everything through. And the essence of statecraft, as I said, is not only marrying objectives and means and understanding how to mobilize additional means, it's also understanding what it takes to do that, understanding the process of negotiations, which is also something that I write about in the book. I give these two examples because they stand in such stark contrast to statecraft being well done versus statecraft being really very poorly done.
Well, do you think that perhaps part of the problem was that the people in the Bush administration were personally so convinced of the rightness of their cause and what they wanted to do that somehow they felt that they shouldn't have to sell it?
Oh, I think that's exactly right. You know, I think that is exactly what happened. There was, and again, some of this stems from the aftermath of 9/11. And a worldview that was shaped by the trauma of 9/11, completely understandable at one level, but a perception that we can't let anything like this happen again, an analysis that I think is a misguided analysis, but an analysis that looks at Saddam Hussein and says he represents the greatest single threat of another 9/11, and we've got to take care of that, and if others don't see it, well, that's just the way it is. We'll proceed, and you know, once we succeed in doing it, others will adjust to the reality that we create. I think that was very much the mindset. I think it gets back to the heart of what you're asking, that they really did believe that they were so right, and that it was so beyond question that those who raised questions really just didn't get it. And we did get it, or at least that part of the administration that felt that got it. And by the way, they even rejected others within the administration who didn't get it. I mean, one of the keys to having good statecraft, by the way, is having administrations that are sufficiently that when an objective is established, everybody works in sync to try to achieve it. In this particular case, you had a basic divide in the administration on Iraq. You have one example I talk about in the book, where the CIA before Saddam Hussein, before the war, before Saddam Hussein fell, wanted to run a simulation on what would happen in Iraq, in Baghdad, once he fell. And the Defense Department refused to take part in it. And the reason is because they felt the people who were running the simulation were against us going to war. And since they were against us going to war, they would simply highlight the problems. And rather than wanting to say, all right, well, you know, maybe they're against the war, but let's see what problems they highlight, let's see what problems they surface, so we can figure out how we're going to contend with those problems. Instead of doing that, because of the ideological divide within the administration, the basic attitude was we discredit the people who oppose us, and we even discredit the questions they raise. That, I think, very much contributed to the problems and the faith-based nature of the analysis or assessment that ultimately guided us in Iraq and ultimately produced what we've now seen.
Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, is Dennis Ross. He served as Middle East envoy and chief peace negotiator in the presidential administrations of George H.W. Bush and also Bill Clinton. He's now a counselor and distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's the author of a newly published book. The title is Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. Farah Strauss-Jurow is the publisher. We have a caller. Others are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The first caller here is in Champaign, line 1. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I find your ideas about elemental stagecraft very interesting. It seems to me that what we have in the United States today is a kind of government that's like what we rejected in 1776, namely a government of the king and cabinet. When we got rid of George III, that's what we got rid of. Now we have a government with a king and a cabinet that doesn't interested in what the people think or what the legislature thinks. So now that kind of government could be made to work if there were experts behind it. In other words, you take the situation in Iraq. There must have been dozens and dozens of people in the State Department that could have told them what would happen after the invasion. But they don't listen to those. They listen only to people in the cabinet, namely people like Karl Rove, Vice President Cheney, Secretary of State, and so on and so forth. They listen to those, and they don't listen to anybody who knows anything. And therefore, you get into these horrible messes. If they would pay attention to people who had expertise, that king and cabinet system might be made to work. I don't like it myself, but it conceivably could be made to work. But I just think it's a terrible system.
Well, I'm not sure that's quite the system that we have. I think you do have to have checks and balances, obviously. But even based on what you were saying, it wasn't just there was a division within the cabinet. Secretary Powell, even though he ends up making the presentation at the UN, he raises questions about the size of the forces that we're committing. He raises questions about what's going to happen when we go into Iraq. He actually quotes something that Tom Friedman said about saying, using the Pottery Barn rule, that you break it, you own it. So, there was some division on the inside. He had people in the State Department produced a Future of Iraq study that had volumes and raised many of the issues that were going to, in fact, emerge, including one of which was the looting as a potential problem. All of it was simply dismissed. So part of what you're contending with is that you had within the government those who were making the decision. They chose not to listen to those within the administration who actually saw the nature of what we were getting into, and I think that helps to explain some of what went wrong.
I agree entirely. Yeah, right. Exactly. I mean, if you have the concentration of power, the people who actually make the decisions cut off from the whatever intelligent dialogue there might be, that there's a chasm there, then you get this kind of problem.
Well, in a sense, what you're describing is what I call groupthink. I describe it in the book. The danger of groupthink is that nobody is there to challenge any of the conventional wisdoms or the assumptions that may be misguided. Now, it's critical in administrations to have a diversity of point of view, but then also have someone who can make decisions. In the administrations that I was in that I thought worked most effectively, you had serious issues thrashed out in serious ways. Where there wasn't a unanimity of view, in the end, decisions were reached, and you proceeded to act. But you really do have to have that diversity represented, and then you have to have someone who is a decision maker who concludes when it's time to actually make a decision and move. I'm afraid that in this administration, either you've had the groupthink or you've had division that was paralyzing. That's why I say in the first term of the administration, there was no policy on Iran because there were two schools of thought, regime change versus engagement, and nobody ever made a decision. So basically, we just allowed the Europeans to guide the policy because we didn't have one.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thanks.
Somebody else get on.
Let's go to another Champagne listener. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. How are you today?
Good.
I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Good, thank you.
You discussed the issue of 9/11 being a contributing motivational factor for the administration entering into Iraq. But I was wondering how much of an influence the American Enterprise Institute played along with that. Particularly when you read the letters in 1998 to then-President Clinton.
Right.
And then also in 2001, following the 9/11 attacks, there was another letter written to President Bush, which essentially stated that even if there isn't a connection between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, you still need to go into Iraq. and for regime change. So it appears that even when you read PNAC's model, which was released in September 2000 regarding the foreign policy of the Bush administration, you have these key members of these particular organizations who were hell-bent on regime change within Iraq, and then they enter the administration and they carry those ideas along into the administration.
Now, I think what is important, and this gets to the whole notion of the groupthink, there was an intellectual underpinning that was provided for the groupthink by those who had a particular mindset. There are certainly a number of places inside the administration and outside the administration where that intellectual underpinning was provided. That certainly contributes because it provides a rationale.
Okay.
But I have to say I wouldn't overstate it, because in the end, you know, you have the president makes a decision. If you go and you look back and trace the case, and I have a chapter in the book. The book is shaped in a way that's designed to sort of explain what statecraft is and then look at a number of cases of relatively recent history to see examples of statecraft that are done well and examples of statecraft done badly, one of which is the Iraq case, which I have as a chapter. And then I look at some of the tools of statecraft, and then I apply it prospectively to a number of cases, the Israeli-Palestinian, dealing with radical Islam, Iran, and the rise of China. But the Iraq case in particular is interesting because you see very early on President Bush is riveted on Iraq. And he doesn't need outsiders to get him to be focused on Iraq. He's riveted on Iraq. From the second day, he's already saying, you know, I think they were involved in it.
Right.
He comes into a meeting that Condi Rice is having with a couple of senators, you know, relatively early on, and basically says, we're going to get Iraq. He gives 72 days after 9/11, he tells Tommy Franks, put together a war plan for Iraq. I mean, I think one can talk about the intellectual underpinnings and who provides it, but the fact of the matter is he has it very much in mind relatively soon after 9/11. And that's why I come back and I say, and I don't say it in an accusatory way. I'm saying it in terms of trying to understand where did the mindset come from and why was it so strongly rooted and what guided it. And I think you cannot underestimate the impact of 9/11 on transforming the nature of the administration, transforming the president's own view of the world, and his role and mission. And Iraq, very early on, becomes, in his mind, connected to what it is he has to prevent. You can say that there are those who are generating a perception of Iraq, but he seems to have it very much in mind early on. So I think maybe outsiders contributed to it, but certainly I don't think one should diminish how much he had this in mind and how early he had it in mind.
Okay. Because Francis Fukuyama addresses that issue at times, and I know he was a major supporter of the Iraq invasion. Now he tends to be a critic of the method in which it was carried out. But one final issue, and I'll hang up after I ask this. Can you, when we were discussing the administration's unwillingness to go before the United, or maybe you weren't necessarily discussing it, but the administration's unwillingness to go before the United Nations Security Council to seek approval for an invasion. From my readings, or from what I understand, Britain had a great deal of influence in convincing the administration to seek a resolution.
That's true.
So if you can address that,
I will.
And I appreciate your time. And like I said, I'm looking forward to reading your book. Thank you.
Thank you
very
much.
Thank you. Tony Blair explained to the president that it was very important for him to have a second resolution. And the president felt that, you know, he needed to help Blair. Now, what I say in the book is it's one thing to say you need a second resolution. What Blair didn't need was a failed second resolution. He would have been better off not having an attempt for a second resolution if it was going to fail. The point I was trying to make earlier is, in the case of the earlier Gulf War, Margaret Thatcher was actually against going for what amounted to that kind of a resolution. Secretary Baker was convinced that we needed it, but also said, we'll never expose it, we'll never surface it, unless we know we can succeed in getting it. And what the Bush administration did is respond to Blair, but make things even worse for Blair by pushing for it in the open and failing to get it. They should have explored this very privately to see if they could get it. They should have seen what it would take to get it before they ever surfaced anything. And they didn't do that, and they paid the price for it.
You know, I find myself thinking here that a major issue is, a major problem is being unrealistic in one's objectives and goals. And that is in the sense that perhaps you hope you can do or you believe that you can do more than you can, which it makes me wonder whether it might not be such a bad idea to have a big sign put up in the Oval Office that says something like, don't think that you can change the world. Because, you know, maybe in one sense it's good to actually be optimistic and think that you can, but be realistic and realize that chances are probably no, you can't.
Well, I think I say in the book that you can have ambitious objectives, but they have to be tempered by reality. You can want to have transformational ambitions, but they have to be guided in a sense by understanding what reality is. You have to know what reality is before you can change it. One of the things about this administration, as I said, is too often its assessments have been faith-based, not reality-based. What I mean by faith-based is ideologically driven. You don't let the facts get in the way. You don't let reality get in the way. But you have to understand reality. I'm afraid even now, in terms of the Secretary of State is very much focused on the idea of a political horizon for the Israelis and the Palestinians, meaning, what are the contours of a permanent status agreement? Now, at a time when we have an Israeli prime minister with a 2% approval rating, when we have, now we literally have a divided Palestinian government where Hamas is controlling Gaza and we're going to have a Palestinian Authority that controls the West Bank, their capacity to embrace a permanent status agreement which involves existential compromise for each side is very limited. Arab states' readiness to embrace these compromises, which could make it, in a sense, could provide a cover to do these steps, is also very limited. Where you need to be focused right now is on the competition between Fatah and Hamas and how that's going to come out. That will determine whether you can engage in peacemaking. If Hamas ends up winning that competition, you're out of the peacemaking business because you've transformed a national conflict into a religious conflict. Mm-hmm. So here's a case where you have to understand the reality in order to understand what's the right objective at the appropriate time. It doesn't mean you have to give up your ambition, but successful statecraft or diplomacy is heavily guided by understanding what the circumstances are today. If you want to change them, that's fine, but you've got to focus on how you do that today so that you can change the circumstances for tomorrow.
Well, just to stay with that example, and I certainly did want to ask you about this and get the benefit of your experience, in a particular case like this where we have the two sides in what seems to amount to a civil war, we're now at the point where the two parts of the territories are each occupied by the two rival factions, and we have two groups that seem to be so fundamentally opposed to each other, have such different agendas. How would one go about trying to bring the two of them together, just to bring the two of them together to start talking with one another? Is there in fact some positive role here the United States can play?
Well, I think we have to focus on what it is we're trying to do and what it is that is possible to do. First, you have a fundamental divide between Palestinians right now in terms of who they are, what their identity is going to be, and what they want it to be. Hamas wants an Islamic State. It wants it ruled by Sharia. Hamas is both a movement and a government, and whenever there's a conflict between the movement and the movement always succeeds. Now, Fatah is a national secular group. Their principle is to create a Palestinian state. Their objective, or at least they've been committed in principle, to a two-state solution, something that Hamas rejects. We have a fundamental stake in the competition between them. Now, we don't have an interest in sort of fomenting violent conflict between them, although if you look at Hamas's behavior in Gaza, it's clear that they made a calculation that they were simply going to subdue Fatah in Gaza, and for the most part they seem to have succeeded in doing that. They're much weaker in the West Bank than they are in Gaza. The West Bank is also a much larger population than Gaza. And one of the things we have to do is focus on
how to make Fatah a national secular movement and faction, how to make it more competitive, assuming they're prepared to remake themselves. Part of Fatah's problems are of their own making because of the nature of corruption, because of the absence of infusion of younger leadership, because it's become discredited in the eyes of many Palestinians. But there is, I'm just back from the area, and it's clear that many of the younger members of Fatah and independents understand that they now have to focus on how they're going to organize themselves at the grassroots level, begin to compete at the grassroots level, begin to provide not just words but services as a way of showing that they can embody social justice. Hamas built an appeal based not only on jihad but also on the basis of the dawah, building what amounts to a kind of social welfare system. Fatah, too, has to be prepared to operate on that kind of a basis. To the extent to which they need help from the outside to do it, we can provide it. The Saudis and others, Gulf states, can provide it. The Israelis also have to be aware of how they make life easier for Fatah or make it harder for Fatah. So there's a lot of different elements that you're going to have to be operating on at the same time, helping to be involved, helping to play a role in that. The U.S., you know, could be active now. Truth be told, we never should have walked away from the peace process 6 years ago. By removing a sense of possibility, a sense of hope, that also contributed to Hamas's success, because Hamas could say, look, there's no possibility of peace anyway. Fatah doesn't deliver anything, either in terms of the political prospects for the future or in terms of who they represent with regard to responding to Palestinian needs. So a huge mistake, a strategic mistake, I think a historic mistake, was made by walking away in the past. Now, the Secretary of State wants to be involved, which I applaud, but if she wants to be involved in the service of an objective that can't be achieved, it's one more example of a mismatch between objectives and means, and it's one more example of pursuing an objective that will soon be discredited. That's the last thing we need in the Middle East right now.
We have about 10 minutes, 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dennis Ross. He served as Middle East envoy and peace negotiator in two presidential administrations, the first Bush administration and also in the Clinton administration. He is now a counselor and distinguished fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and is the author of a newly published book, Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. He's now traveling around talking about the book and was good enough to give us some of his time this morning. We have several callers here. We'll try to get everybody in, but also please, callers, keep in mind that we're getting near the end of the program, and it will help if you can be brief in your comments. Next, we'll talk with someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
I think I've got two comments and one question, if I can keep them in mind. One is, I get really worried whenever somebody talks about, in government, about faith and God, and then we're worried about Bush thinking he talks to God, and when his administration talks about God's the American standard of living being something that we is God given right up practically. He didn't say it quite that way, but that's the idea. It makes me very worried. It doesn't. Experience shows that that kind of thinking is not good. So that's one thing. Second observation is that Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, none of them were in Vietnam. And yet, over a long period of time, well, particularly Cheney and Rumsfeld, they've been involved in policies that don't reflect any experience with what it's really, really like on the ground. And then my other question is, in relationship to that, I think I've seen it on Frontline, maybe on Now with David Moncaccio or Bill Moyers, images of Cheney and Rumsfeld years ago. I think were they both in the Nixon administration? Do I have it correctly?
They were both in the Ford administration, when Rumsfeld was in the Nixon administration.
And I'm wondering how much the having been involved in politics that long, and Rumsfeld being in the Nixon administration, how much Nixon's peccadilloes and the way that played out, how much that affected Rumsfeld's views on what you allow the media to know, what you allow other people to give as input, et cetera. Do you talk about anything like that far back, way beyond 9/11?
I don't really deal with, I'm dealing more with more recent examples of history because I wanted to demonstrate that in the cases I was looking at, these were cases that pretty much straddled the end of the Cold War or after the Cold War, because I wanted to show statecraft in action in an era that is relevant to the era we face now, where there are different kinds of challenges. One thing that we deal with in the international landscape, and I have a chapter on this, is we do have certain challenges that we face that reflect more traditional kinds of challenges, but we also see new challenges that are different than we've seen before. We face challenges from non-state actors. We face the challenge of failing states. And there's a kind of new reality that is created because of that. And I wanted to create more of a context that is relevant to that we face today. So that's why I don't deal with more distant cases. I must say that when I was writing the book, I debated whether or not to draw on some other cases of statecraft from the more distant past, but I just decided I wanted to make the book more manageable in terms of length, so I didn't pursue that.
Just to pick up very quickly on that point, and again, I want to get on some other folks, do you think that the fact that so many of the people that were important in the administration, people like Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld or Condoleezza Rice, for example, who was a Sovietologist, that was her area of expertise, the fact that all of these people were really grounded in, grew up during the Cold War, when the dynamics of global politics were very different, has that made it difficult for them, do you think, to adjust to a new way of thinking and a new kind of threat?
I'm not sure that it has, although it's a very fair question, because it's not unusual for decision makers to always fall back on the analogies that they know best, and those analogies typically are rooted in different eras. If you go back to Lyndon Johnson, his analogies as it for Vietnam and that era were going back to Munich and World War II and the consequences of appeasement. So you could say when you draw on those kinds of historic analogies, they're not going to work. So it certainly is true that decision makers frequently will draw on historical analogies that may not be apt for the period they're in. And certainly Secretary Rice frequently likes to equate the period immediately after World War II in building the new institutions as a relevant analog to what we are to where we are today. So there certainly are indications of historical analogies being drawn, and you can ask the question, are they the right ones or not? That said, you know, the fact is that's going to be true for almost anybody in any administration at more senior positions. And the real question is, again, how much diversity of thinking do you have? These are smart people who are there, but there was a groupthink. And those who had alternative assumptions tended to be frozen out. So I think that was more the problem than it was that those who were there, you know, knew the world that was really a different world than the one that they were facing.
All right, let's go to another caller, someone on a cell phone. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello. This is really interesting, but I have a problem with something that you said a couple of times, and that is you refer to the administration paying the price. And as far as I can see, the administration per se pays no price for anything. A lot of other people do, practically everybody else in the world, other than Scooter Libby, who may get off anyway, it looks likely. Nobody's paying any price.
I didn't mean the administration paying the price. I said we pay the price.
Oversight here. These people are making rash decisions and getting off scot-free. That's pretty much what I have to say. Bye-bye.
Yeah. Well, all right. Thanks for the comment. Well, I take your point. I don't really think that you did say that, but I suppose what the caller is doing is echoing the comments of a lot of people who say that perhaps the administration hasn't paid as much attention to the costs, both short and long term, of the policy course that they've set out.
Well, I think, look, when I talk about paying the price, I'm talking about the price of a failed policy.
Yeah.
And it's a price that we will pay and the next administration will pay, because the next administration is going to come in and they're going to inherit a legacy. And the legacy is going to involve several different elements. Colin Powell likes to say the army is broken. The next administration is going to inherit that reality. we're going to inherit the reality of Iraq, because it will certainly be, it will not be close to being resolved when the next administration comes in. So we, across the board, you're going to deal with a number of legacies that are going to be difficult and painful, not to mention the fact of who's paid the price for the policies to date. So I'm, you know, when I'm talking about paying the price, I'm talking about the consequences of failed policies. And when you have bad statecraft, you're going to have bad policies.
Next caller is in Chicago. This is line number four.
Thank you. In terms of the realities, Billy Graham was recently have remarked that he wished he had talked to President Bush about the matters of the Shia, Sunni, and other cultural religious factors so that they would know much more than they seem to have lacked in terms of perspective. I think I wanted that remark to be placed in the context of what you're talking, that he did not know all those factors that we are now reckoning with in terms of their determined stand. And we certainly have to realize that unless we do, we're just going to be on this sort of treadmill, you know. And as Secretary Baker has said in the background, underlying all of this, we have a foreign policy that states we will go to war to maintain our access to oil. So those circumstances are underlying all the facts. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, you want to comment on that at all?
Well, I think, I mean, the essence of what was being said is, in a sense, what I've been saying all along in this conversation so far. You have to have reality-based assessments, meaning you better know what you're getting into. And pretty clear that we didn't.
I'm sure that in the course of negotiations, mediations, and when you're engaged in diplomacy, it means that you're going to have to talk with people that maybe you don't like, but that you're going to have to do it anyway. Is it a problem if you start out before you even begin negotiations by saying that there are certain people that we're simply not going to talk to?
You know, I think, and I do have a chapter on who and when and why you negotiate.
Yeah.
I think there have to be criteria. I don't think, one of my arguments generally is, I don't think we should be afraid to engage others. I think the too often the administration, I think, has acted as if it was afraid that if you talk to somebody, it was a form of surrender. Well, it's only a form of surrender if you surrender when you talk. And that's not what negotiations have to be about. In fact, negotiations to be effective often should be based on having a kind of leverage and not diminishing your own leverage before you talk. But I think the key here is recognizing that you should develop different kinds of criteria so you know why you're going to talk, you know what you're going to talk about, you're very clear on that, and that can shape very much how you decide to engage or when you decide to engage. I'm not necessarily in favor of talking to everybody, but I think the point is one shouldn't have a presumption that you're simply not going to talk. One should have a presumption that you're going to talk unless there's a very good reason that you shouldn't.
We have another caller here, Champaign County, line number three. Hello.
Hi. I'm persuaded by the earlier book about this whole reality-based and the faith-based, but I think it can be drawn too far, and I'm afraid you're doing that. I think that the statecraft principle that they were relying on was the use of force, that force would dominate and create the realities, and as diplomacy, you know, war is diplomacy pushed too far. It seems to me the example from the Gaza is that the U.S., under Elliot Abrams' tutelage and sponsorship, was supporting Fatah. They marched a bunch of people in. I think Hamas made the calculation that the escalation was going to continue and the battle was going to be drawn. And this kind of use of force, the impending use of force, precipitated it. And I see that those weapons that were shipped in to the Gaza are probably going to rain down on Israel. There's not much time left, so I just wanted to say that. Thank you.
It's a fair point. Look, let me make 2 points in response. Number one, obviously, force is a tool of statecraft. Hard power is a tool of statecraft. My point generally is you have to know how to integrate all your tools effectively, including the issue of coercion.
the administration had a tendency to believe that the use of force could be transformational in terms of its consequences. And I think you have to be very, I see circumstances where absolutely you have to use force and be willing to use it, but you should be very careful about thinking that you know what the political consequences are going to be. That's point one. Point two, on the issue of Hamas and Gaza, I don't believe it was because arms were provided to Fatah that that's what precipitated Hamas. Bear in mind that Hamas, just to give you an example of how long they've been planning this, they blew up the headquarters of the Preventive Security Organization with a tunnel that they had created underneath it. That tunnel probably took 4 or 5 months to be able to produce, at least. So they've been planning this for some time. Now, the tunnel is probably there as a kind of contingent option, but the fact that they did it suggests that they certainly had it in mind, and this isn't something that was done just a couple of weeks ago.
Well, I am sorry to say that we're at the point where we have to conclude because we're at the end of the time. If you'd like to read more from our guest, look for this book that I mentioned. It's titled Statecraft and How to Restore America's Standing in the World. You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.uiuc.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 3 minutes before noon Central Time. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, registered dietitian Susan Kundrat of Nutrition on the Move will join us to talk about diet and nutrition. She'll join us following the 1 o'clock news. The program gets underway here at noon with news from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580. Mike Sola will have the weather at 12:35. I'll tell you his forecast for Illinois and Indiana following this commodity market update. Let's take a look at what's happening in Kansas City with that September wheat contract. It is trading at 647.5, up 7.75. December, 662.5, up 7.5. In Chicago, September wheat, 660.5, up 10.5. December, 679, up 10. March, 671, up 9.75. September corn, 319.5, down 7. December, 335.75, down 7.25. March, 351.25, down 7.5. December, 08, 387, down 6.25. August beans, 818.5, down 20.5. September, 827, down 17.75. November, 842.75, down 18.25. And August soy bean meal trading at 218 even, down 420. August oil, 36.47, down 88. At the Merck, August feeder cattle, 116.22.5, up 30. August live cattle, 93.60, unchanged. October, 98.12.5, up 15. August lean hog, 74 even, down 37.5. Outside markets, September crude, 72.99. Latest tick down 249. The CRB index 312.76, down 541. The U.S. dollar 80.23, down 8. The Dow is up 134 at 13,316. The NASDAQ up 14 at 2525. The S&P 500 up 16 points at 4.